Hello there. Welcome to the Frenchie Podcast, a show dedicated to the stories and legacies of the French-speaking Cajuns of World War II, as told by the veterans themselves. I'm your host, Jason Terrio. For over 20 years, I've been interviewing World War II veterans and capturing their stories. Many of them were Cajun, people of Acadian descent. When these young Cajuns went overseas, their ability to speak French proved invaluable to military operations, and it had a profound impact on their sense of Acadian identity. What emerged from this unique wartime experience was a long-lost pride in their heritage. When the military needed bilingual interpreters, they called on Frenchie to bridge the language gap.
Now, if you'd have had visionaries during that period of time who could have determined that coordinating the French and the English language,
two-track system,
if you'd have had the vision, we might have been better off.
That was the voice of Kearney Dronnet and Bob LeBlanc, two legendary Acadian citizen soldiers from Vermilion Parish. This newly discovered recording was from nearly 30 years ago. I discovered this rare interview at the Center for Louisiana Studies archives and realized that it was part of my friend Shane Bernard's dissertation research for what later became his important book, Cajuns, Americanization of a People. The interview is unique in so many ways, folks. For one, it captures the story of Bob LeBlanc's harrowing OSS experience in France with the underground, in his own words. But it also provides a fascinating perspective on the early educational struggles of the Cajuns of that great generation who were forced to learn English in school in the 1920s. These two men were not only inducted as living legends into the Acadian Museum in Erath, but they also served as commanders of the Louisiana National Guard during the post-war era. These Acadian citizen soldiers never forgot those difficult schoolhouse years as they carried their Cajun French language and identity into military service. Yet by the time World War II erupted, the very language many had once been punished for speaking became a valuable wartime asset. In this episode of the Frenchie Podcast, we explore that remarkable transformation through the voices of two legends as they reflect on Cajun identity, language, military service, and the generation that became known simply as the Frenchies.
It's amazing how fast a young child can learn a foreign language.
I've been thinking about that. Returning back to the classroom, most of the French speaking was prohibited, was on in the recess area. Not necessarily in school, but out on the grounds that we were playing. When you were in the classroom, you were supervised, and the teacher wouldn't permit you to speak French. But when you were out on the playgrounds, then you had your friends around you. That's all you could. The only way you could communicate was to speak in French. And so, the minute the teacher would walk towards you, you'd quit speaking French, and then she'd warn you. Speak French, we're gonna punish you, or like you said, maybe kneel down. I don't recall what it was.
The discipline was much stricter in my time than in your time. You listened to what the teacher had to say. They were the boss. They did other embarrassing things, such as telling you that you're somebody you don't know how to speak English or something like that.
Writing.
They put you down. At that particular time, we had a lot of teachers who came from North Louisiana to teach. We had Miss Lewis, we had Miss Charlie Caldwell. All these teachers were from out of Vermilion Parish. They all had degrees in education. Oh, a lot of them couldn't even speak French themselves.
So my judgment is that we in this area were so far behind as far as education was concerned. And really and truly, they had to enforce Bert Webb and his wife were both the principal, and she was, as I told you, my first great teacher. They were brought in here by Williams, by J.H. Williams, in order to be principal, because we didn't have the qualified people to do so in this area.
You mean they couldn't speak French?
No, they couldn't speak French at all.
Yeah.
They were brought in here from Mississippi. He mentions that the other kids would speak English. In Abbeville, they may have had some that could speak English.
Mm-hmm.
But in Erath, when I went to school, nobody in that first grade could speak English.
Mm-hmm.
I'll venture to say right now that I could look at my first grade photograph, and none of us could speak English. None.
Folks, this is rare and remarkable insight. Two Cajuns of World War II speaking candidly about a transformative period in Louisiana history that shaped their generation and continues to have long-term repercussions even today. I want to pause here for a moment and bring in my good friend, the ambassador of the Cajun people, Warren Perrin, to tell us about these two legendary men and what they did for the community of Vermilion Parish and for our culture. Welcome back, Warren.
It's great to hear from you, Jason. I greatly appreciate your invitation for me to participate in the Friendship Podcast again. We at the Acadian Museum of Erath and the Acadian Heritage and Culture Foundation have really enjoyed and consider ourselves fortunate to have been a partner with you in developing this podcast. As you know, we had this wonderful event at the World War II Museum, and it just brings back wonderful memories of reliving the lives of many of these Cajun veterans who dedicated their lives to saving freedom for the world. And many of those were Cajun soldiers who grew up, of course, being prohibited from speaking French, as did both Commander Kearney Dronet and Bob LeBlanc, who both, as most people probably recognized, were very active in not only the Army, but also in the Louisiana National Guard. What really strikes me about their careers, as we inducted both of them into our Order of Living Legends, was the fact that not only were they successful military careers, but also business careers. And in that capacity, although they were raised in the Jim Crow era of segregation, when the chips were down, they both stuck their necks out and were called upon by Governor John McKithen to protect civil rights protesters who marched from Bogalusa, Louisiana to Baton Rouge to meet with the governor in an attempt to settle some serious civil rights issues. During that time, there were terrible assassinations, and so it was a very, very high-risk mission that these men successfully carried out. In another situation, in 1971, I think it was, at Southern University, there was a protest that went awry, and two students were accidentally shot and killed, and tensions were so high, they called upon the National Guard, led by Bob LeBlanc, to quell that disturbance, and of course he did it with great ease. We at the museum are proud to have a say in keeping this history alive, and we just today hosted another busload of French tourists. We get them once a month, 50 of them come from all over the French-speaking world, and it's always a highlight of the two-week trip that they spend in the United States. Finally, since this is the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution, we've been asked to put on talks over the next 3 months, which will deal with the way that the Acadians not only inspired, but fought with the Spanish militia in defeating the British along the Mississippi and the Gulf Coast and helping to win the American Revolution. So we look forward to continuing the good work that you are doing, and please feel free to come by and visit the museum in Erath at any occasion. You can visit our website, acadianmuseum.com. Merci beaucoup.
Thank you, Warren. Always good to catch up with old friends and give a thank you to those like yourself who helped plant the seed for this podcast series going back to 2021. And looking over my shoulder on the wall of memorabilia here in the Frenchie Podcast studio, I see a framed poster of the To Honor Our Veterans Volume 3 book from 2005. It was actually a book signing in Brobridge. And on the back cover is a blurb from you, Warren, that says, in 2005, the estimated 3 million Acadians in the world, including the Cajuns of Louisiana, commemorated the 250th anniversary of the deportation of their ancestors by the British from Nova Scotia. There can be no better time than this anniversary for Jason Terrio to pen his excellent study of the role that Cajuns played during World War II. So many thanks, Warren, for supporting this project going way, way back to the beginning. Now let's pick back up that Shane Bernard interview with those two legends, World War II.
But it was an unwritten thing that you don't speak French on a school ground because we want you to learn English.
Mm-hmm.
The objective was to learn English. Well, you could have had a two-track system, which would have been invaluable mm-hmm. to the country. And my knowledge of French proves this to mm-hmm. me because even today, the Army is having to run a language school to be able to provide the necessary resources that they need and for their operations. The language school teaches English, I mean, teaches French, teaches German, teaches Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no reason for this. We got Spanish kids in the United States, we got German areas. We got Cajun areas that can provide this necessary knowledge by having a two-track system, which Porterfield came through with.
Now, if you'd have had visionaries during that period of time, who could have determined that coordinating the French and the English language,
two-track system.
If you'd have had the vision, if those people would have had the visions.
Mm-hmm.
At the state or at the parish level or at the parish level, because this was peculiar to this area, the fact that we couldn't speak English, we might have been better off mm-hmm. than we were. But no, he's right. I wanted to be an American. Mm-hmm. I didn't care to be a French. I mentioned to you that I didn't feel the French were polite and mm-hmm. and they were rude.
Now, getting back to the French, I had no problems in France speaking French and making myself understood. We use a term here, which is called, at this moment, I sit up. Mm-hmm. You speak French?
At this hour?
At this hour. The correct French is maintenant.
Uh-huh.
You follow what I'm talking about?
Now, yeah.
You evidently know a little French.
A little French.
All right. When I was in Europe and when I was in France, I was at Sens, and we were having a supper for the underground, and after we liberated this town, we were having this supper with these French people. And I used the term a stir, and everybody popped out laughing,
mm-hmm.
except the old lady who was sitting on the end. And she said, mon garçon, et you vous avez appris ce mot-là. And I told her, I learned it when I was a child. She says, I have not heard that word since I was a child.
Mm-hmm.
But she said, that's exactly the way we spoke when I was a child. So the French that she spoke when she was a child was what was imported with the Cajuns.
Hmm.
And there were a lot of words that we were able to relate in my conversations with her childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And these were the things that impressed me. What a valuable asset we had in South Louisiana and the ability to speak French. And I feel that it's an asset that we're losing. My grandchildren learned it in their school, mm-hmm. but they didn't learn it in the home like I did.
Mm-hmm.
And learning it out of a book is not conversational French.
Mm-hmm.
Because conversational French is Brooklynese. no matter where you go in the world, you got different types of French. You got slang. And that's what you have to have. Normandy, Brittany, and country French is very similar to our French. Mm-hmm. Unlike Kearney, when I went to Paris during the war, Parisian French was like Brooklynese to me.
Now, do you two speak the same kind of French?
Oh, yes. Yes. Absolutely, the same thing.
It's the
same slang, same Cajun. We use the same Cajun words.
But you had the same thing with the West Virginians.
Mm-hmm. Appalachia.
A boot. Yeah. And they have a different slang. The Kentuckians had a different slang. So each platoon that I got in was different culture. Mm-hmm. And you understood, because whenever you had a platoon of people, you had them from all over the United States. And that culture didn't matter to you. It was the ability to perform the mission that mattered.
You had mentioned that your nickname with some soldiers was Frenchie.
Frenchie, yeah.
I've seen that occur also in other instances where you had a lone Cajun immersed in a group of non-Cajuns, but when you have a lot of Cajuns together in a platoon or whatever, you can't call all of them Frenchie.
Well, folks, that's classic Shane Bernard right there, and he's exactly right. In the military, one Cajun might get called Frenchie, but when an entire guard unit from South Louisiana showed up speaking French, as they did at Camp Landing, Florida, or in Camp Bowie, Texas, well, you couldn't exactly point to just one guy anymore. And that's what made the Cajun National Guard story so unique. By the early years of World War II, the Louisiana National Guard had entire companies made up of French-speaking Cajuns all training together. Young men from places like New Iberia, Abbeville, St. Martinville, Brobridge, Houma, Jennings, many of whom had grown up getting fussed at in school for speaking French. A few years later, Uncle Sam suddenly needed every bit of that language skill he could get, especially in places like North Africa. And folks, that remarkable story of the Cajun National Guard during World War II will be the focus of an upcoming presentation at the Jackson Barracks Museum in New Orleans on May the 14th, 6:30. That's Jackson Barracks Museum in New Orleans, May 14th, Thursday night, 6:30 in New Orleans. I'll be giving a talk on the Cajun National Guard in World War II. And if you want to go back to earlier episodes, I think it's episode 5 and 6. You can catch a 2-part podcast series on the Cajun National Guard of World War II. All right, in this next clip, Bob LeBlanc talks about how his French guided him and his special forces team behind the lines working with the French underground following the breakout of Normandy.
Part of our training involved reassigned agents from France being debriefed. And we were behind a glass, and we had to listen to their debriefings to know what was going on in France, in case we were the next ones to go into France. But that was part of our training. So we had to know French real well, because these individuals spoke, a lot of them were Parisians, some of them were Europeans, and There were agents who had been dropped into France, had been compromised and smuggled out. And we were particularly interested in the manner in which they were compromised, you see, because it would have been something for us to do. We went through this entire training and were ready to go jump in as JED teams. We were scheduled to go to North Africa and jump in Southern France.
What does that mean, a JED?
JEDburg teams or OSS teams. They're like Taipei teams in OSS today.
Why do they call them that?
It was just a terminology they used to indicate what the teams were. It's what you have as commander of the team. You had a signal officer, a medical, and you had operational people who trained the Maquis in the utilization of the small arms and all of the weapons that were necessary. So just at the time that this occurred, We were called to number 10 Downing Street, which is OSS headquarters in London. There was about 12 of us that were called on there, of the Mackie, of the jet teams. And they, at that time, we didn't know this, they were planning the invasion in June, and they needed highly qualified Special Forces officers to coordinate between the Army and the French underground, the activities of the underground. And they needed somebody with top secret clearance who knew how to speak French, who knew the Mackie, who knew the Jedburgh teams, who knew where they were, and the entire system that went on in France. So 12 of us were assigned to the armies. It happened to be my luck that I was assigned to George S. Patton, U.S. Third Army. We ended up training in France until we went up, training in Europe, England, until we crossed and went into France on July the 17th, I think it is, of 1944, right after the invasion. We set up behind the lines, ready for the breakout. And during that period of time, we polished up our French with some of the agents who had been overrun, and we were given missions as to what we were going to do. And we studied the agents that were in the front of the lines, who they were, what their passwords were, what systems we'd use for identification. And it was our job to go through the line, contact these agents, and give them specific missions to do. And we did this. We had to break out at Saint-Lô and Avranches. And I was assigned to the 8th Corps. General Troy H. Middleton was the commander of the 8th Corps. And you heard that name before. He was president of LSU, LSU. I was extremely fortunate he assigned me to the 4th Armored Division. The 4th Armored Division was the breakout unit. It dashed the Rennes. From Rennes it went to Van Ness. From Van Ness to Lorient. And it cut off the Brittany Peninsula. We always had a guide from the underground to guide us where we were going. We took back roads. For instance, when we got to Rennes, I went all the way to Brest. Well, it was some 7 months later before Brest was relieved.
You must have been seeing Germans left and right, though.
Well, yes, but we always had the system to get in and out.
You were dressed
sometimes
like...
we used French cars, sometimes we used motorcycles, sometimes we used Jeeps.
You were dressed like a civilian.
Always dressed in military uniform. Hmm. We didn't take a chance because then you were a spy. Oh. And we did this, and we provided security for the convoys of Patton. We provided guards for the prisoner of war, so to relieve the advance, so that they could continue the advance. We provided intelligence, anything that Patton desired, we did. Mm-hmm. Then we went from there to Orleans, Joan of Arc's famous territory. From there we went up to Sens, Troyes, and into Nancy. While we were at Nancy, we went to went all the way up into the off to the German border. At that time, there were no Germans in that area because they were in southern France. But we ran out of fuel, so we had to stop there, and the Germans infiltrated and went into the line. We did this all the way up to the German border, and then when the German we got to the German border, they took all the French-speaking agents and sent them back to England for parachute training. And from England, we came back to the United States. We spent 2 months, 3 months here in the United States, and they sent us to China. They sent us to Kunming, China, with the intention of utilizing us in Indochina, which is Vietnam today.
Now, while Bob LeBlanc carried his Cajun French language skills into occupied France as an OSS officer, working with the French Marquis, his good friend, Kearney Drunet, served the war effort in a different role. Drunet remained stateside as a bombardier instructor, helping train the next generation of American airmen during the height of the war. Both men, however, emerged from that wartime generation of Cajun servicemen and continued their military careers long after the guns fell silent, eventually rising to become commanders of the Louisiana National Guard, 256th Infantry Brigade. Drunet never forgot what it was like growing up a Cajun and speaking French in South Louisiana during the English-only school era of the 1920s. Following a 30-year career with the Guard, he wrote and published three books, A Memoir of His Life, A Long History of the 256th Infantry Brigade, and a history of his community, Erath, titled A Century of Acadian Culture. Here's an excerpt from my telephone interview with Kearney Drunet in 2006 about being Cajun.
So we were relatively new here in Erath. The Cajuns had moved there, had migrated to this parish.
Yes, sir.
And most of them were really uneducated. The reason that the French language began to become, not obsolete, but declining, is because during the school days, during my school days, we were punished if we spoke French on the school ground. On the school ground, now mind you, we didn't speak it in the classroom. But if we spoke French on the school ground, there was some punishment that was attributed to us speaking French. So we had to necessarily, while we were on the playground, we had to speak English. We were punished. But education really became strong in the 30s. And of course, when we began to send our kids through school, we only had 11 grades, if you remember then. We didn't have 12 grades like we have now.
Right.
Only 11 grades. But with the coming of the oil, people began to have money, became affluent. Many of them became affluent with this money. Although they were uneducated, money made them affluent. And quite candidly, we all began to prosper quite well. So we became affluent from the 40s on. And of course, going into World War II, everybody went to World War II. Oh, I think that certainly it continued the transformation of Cajuns, the enhancement of the Cajun culture. Because formerly, before the 30s, Cajuns were not thought highly of, neither by our neighbors, our English neighbors, and by the entire United States. They always referred to the Cajuns as being marsh-dwelling trappers, ignorant farmers, very family-oriented, always family-oriented. And yes, I certainly believe that the Cajun culture began to really grow, and the pride of becoming a Cajun really began to grow with World War II and following World War II.
Spoken like a true Frenchie of World War II. For that Cajun generation, the war changed more than just their lives. It changed how many of them saw themselves. Young men who had once been discouraged from speaking French in Louisiana suddenly found their language, culture, and heritage valued by the United States military on a global stage during the war and for decades after. And that, folks, is really the message behind the Frenchie Project: to preserve the voices of this remarkable Cajun generation and to better understand how World War II helped shape Cajun identity in modern Louisiana. That will do it for this episode of the Frenchie Podcast. Special thanks to Warren Perrin for an update on the Acadian Museum and to Shane Bernard for having the foresight so many years ago to bring these two legends together for such an important conversation. And thanks, as always, to my good friends at the Center for Louisiana Studies for preserving these recordings, especially Chris Segura and Josh Caffrey, whose musical jingles remind you that this is indeed the Frenchie Podcast. Until next time, thanks for listening. And if you're in the New Orleans area, come join us at the Jackson Barracks Museum on the evening of May the 14th as we continue exploring the remarkable story of the Cajun National Guard from World War II.